We'll begin with a Vipassana meditation. And coming up in the text at the bottom of page 9, it says, although in the scriptures, along with their commentaries, the selflessness of person is determined first, when meditating, it is necessary to first meditate on the selflessness of person. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to do a Vipassana practice by examining ourselves as the person. How do I exist? So that's what we're going to do now. We begin with preparing the body. Setting the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. Allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly. And setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Simply allowing it to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Maintaining that ongoing flow of mindfulness. Now, do you have a sense that there's a me here who is meditating? A me that seems to exist from its own side. A me that doesn't seem to depend upon anything else to exist. Do you have this experience? Can we find the me who is meditating anywhere? Is it anywhere to be found? Can the me who is meditating be found anywhere within the body? Search thoroughly every part of the body and look for the me who is meditating. Is the me somewhere inside the head? Is the brain the me who is meditating? Or is the brain simply something which I possess? Something which me, the meditator, is using? Is the whole body itself, is that the me who is meditating? Or is the whole body itself merely something I possess? Something which me, the meditator, is trying to relax? Can me, the meditator, be found anywhere within the mind? So again, search thoroughly every part of the mind and look for the me who is meditating. Are any of the thoughts, emotions, or concepts in the mind, are any of these the me who is meditating? Or are thoughts, emotions, and concepts merely things I possess? Things which me, the meditator, has? Is the mind itself, is that the me who is meditating? Or is the mind itself simply something which I possess, something which me, the meditator, is using to focus on the breath? Is the combination of the body and the mind, is that the me who is meditating? Or is the combination of the body and the mind simply two things which I possess? Two things which me, the meditator, is trying to train. Yet, other than the body and the mind, what else is there here? If there's nothing more than the body and the mind here, then where is the me who possesses this body and mind? And he's trying to train this body and mind. Where is the me who is meditating? If you can't find the me, simply rest in the experience of not finding. And even if you didn't find the me, isn't there someone experiencing all of this? So there is a me meditating. But how can this me exist if we don't seem to be able to find it? The me exists as something merely labelled on the basis of the body that is sitting here and the mind that is focusing on the breath. The merely labelled me is sitting here meditating. And then release all appearances and allow the mind to come to rest. Resting in awareness itself. Without doing anything at all. Just be. Resting in luminously clear awareness. Any questions about that meditation?
Can you just explain the word merely?
Merely, that's coming up. We're going to talk about that. I mean, merely means only or just,
yeah.
But what it really means is it's coming up in the text.
There is a tendency to think that me somewhere around the heart, in the area of the heart, kind of.
Sometimes. Sometimes, particularly if we're being threatened or we're quite emotional, it seems more like here. But then if we're doing a lot of thinking, it seems like it's more here. I mean, it moves around, doesn't it? Elusive. Okay, let's go back into the text then. So we're on page 9. And we've just started the second outline to try to get to the essence of all of these oral instructions, these Vipassana oral instructions in Mahamudra that are trying to guide the person to realize the nature of the mind. And so here we're looking at a very clear methodical explanation based on Lama Tsongkhapa in terms of how to come to understand this emptiness, the ultimate nature of the mind. So we're down second last paragraph. It says, furthermore, with respect to directly realizing selflessness, and remember here, selflessness in this system we're following, this Majjhimika system, or more specifically, Prasangika Majjhimika system, selflessness and emptiness mean the same thing. They're equivalent. So just keep that in mind here. So with respect to directly realizing selflessness, or in other words, realizing emptiness, it is necessary to meditate having first determined selflessness through hearing and contemplating. So remember those three stages we go through in our practice, in Tibetan, go, nyam, tok, intellectual, experience, realization. So if we want to realize emptiness directly, first, we have to do the goal, the intellectual, meaning we have to read and hear about things and contemplate this idea of emptiness to gain a correct intellectual understanding of emptiness or selflessness. And then we apply that in meditation. Then we meditate. And as we meditate, we come to some taste or experience of selflessness or emptiness, and then we keep deepening that, particularly as we have more stable mind of shamatha, and then that experience can become a realization and eventually a direct realization of selflessness or emptiness. Although for such a selflessness or emptiness, there is no division into coarse and subtle in terms of its entity, in some of the lower schools, philosophical schools, they do have what's called coarse selflessness and subtle selflessness. But here, in this system, there's no such division. It says, there are two types by way of a division into person and phenomena. So often we see the two selflessnesses or the two emptiness, selflessnesses of person, selflessnesses of phenomena. And here, phenomena means everything other than person. And I think that the reason they divide it into two like that is because, again, as we're going to see down the bottom of the page, is when we come to meditate, we first meditate on selflessness as a person or emptiness of person. And he's quoting here Chandrakirti. Chandrakirti, great Indian master, who was also expanding, who was also writing texts and teaching according to this Prasangika Majjhimika understanding of emptiness. Chandrakirti from about the 6th, 7th century. He says, in order to thoroughly liberate migrators, this selflessness was taught to be of two types by way of a division into person and phenomena. Any questions so far? Okay, I'll just keep going then. Although in the scriptures, along with their commentaries, the selflessness of phenomena is determined first, when meditating, it is necessary to first meditate on selflessness of person. So when we look at the various texts which describe this emptiness and how to cultivate it, we often see that it's described using some sort of physical phenomena. For example, in Chandrakirti, entering into the middle way, his text, in his that section where he's looking at how to establish emptiness, then he uses the example of a chariot, a cart, you know, that has wheels and an axle, and so he uses the cart and sort of starts pulling it apart in his text and says, well, where's the cart? You know, we can't find a cart there anywhere. So often then a physical phenomena such as that is used because it's easier to follow the line of reasoning, and because it's a physical, tangible object, it's much easier to work with that intellectually. But then when it comes to meditating, we start to focus on ourselves as a person. The reason being is that person is something very familiar to us, and the wrong way of seeing ourselves as a person is where the whole process starts to go wrong. So therefore, if we focus on ourselves as a person, it's probably going to be the most easy and very most effective as a beginner. Of course, as a beginner, we can focus on phenomena if we want, but much more recommended to start with ourselves as a person. And then he's quoting, based on that, he's quoting this King of Concentration Sutra, which says, just as you discriminate the self, likewise that wisdom can be applied to all. Meaning, once we come to realize selfness as a person or emptiness as a person, we can apply that same wisdom to all other phenomena. The nature of all those phenomena is utterly pure like space. Therefore, by one, all are known. Therefore, by one, all are seen. So by coming to realize, investigating me, the person, and coming to realize emptiness of the person, then if we turn our attention to any other object, it's very easy to realize the emptiness of other phenomena as well. We can apply that same wisdom to other phenomena. And then it says here, with respect to meditating on the selflessness of person, initially it is necessary to identify the object of negation, that which is to be negated. And he's quoting here Shantideva's Bodhisattva Charyavatara, where he says, Without contacting the thing to be investigated, you will not apprehend that thing's non-existence. So this is a very important point, this identifying the object of negation. The object of negation, of course, is the thing we're trying to negate. The thing we're trying to negate here is an inherently existent me, independent person. So actually, before we go any further, and it's going to come up a little bit later in this page, is just terminology, just to be clear on terminology. So what we are negating here is independent existence, that things exist independently. Now, there are a number of terms, and we'll see a few of these terms in the text as we go through, that are used to describe this. Probably the most common term that you will see in many of these types of texts is inherent existence. And inherent existence has the sort of idea of things being self-existent. That things have their own unique nature, that the world is divided up into many separate discrete things, each one being self-existent, having its own unique nature. So that's what inherent existence sort of indicates. Another term that we often see is existing from its own side. So the idea that something exists from its own side has the implication that it does not require an observer for it to exist. It simply exists from its own side. That the world of phenomena is simply already exists from its own side. It's just waiting for us to experience it. So that's what existing from its own side means. And the other term, which is coming up very shortly in the text, in a couple of paragraphs, is true existence. And true existence has the meaning that this word true, generally, something is true if it's not deceiving us. So here, things appear to us to exist independent of us. And if they actually existed in that way, they would be true. Meaning, the way in which things appear and the way in which they exist match. Then they would be true. They're not deceiving us. Deceiving us would be they appear one way and they exist in some other way. So true existence means existing in the same way in which it appears. So these three terms, and there are some other terms that are sometimes used, these three terms, of course, all are talking about independent existence. They're talking about independent existence from slightly different perspectives. This one in terms of self-existent, this one in terms of not needing an observer to exist, and this one in terms of existing in the same way in which it appears. So these are three common terms that are used. In the text coming up, you'll see this term used a few times. Any questions there? Yeah?
Just about the negate.
Right.
Because that's the word that gets
Okay. So coming back to this object of negation, we can talk about to negate it means to it depends on what sort of way in which we negate. We can negate things in a number of ways. In fact, here we can talk about sort of two types of object of negation. Because we can negate something anyway, we'll
does.
Does that say?
Sorry?
But negate in itself, does that mean like to say that?
To refute.
Yeah.
To refute it.
Yeah.
To come to see that it's false. That was means to negate. To negate something here means to come to see that it's false. It's not true. So here, if we go into the text, then it'll become a little bit more obvious. So again, with respect to meditating on selfness as a person, initially it is necessary to identify the object of negation, that which is to be negated. Again, quoting Shantideva, without contacting the thing to be investigated, you will not apprehend that thing's non-existence. Meaning, what we're going to investigate here is this independent me that seems to be here. But if you're going to investigate whether or not it's here, you need to have a clear picture of it. Yeah. Because without a clear picture of it, if you look, you're not going to be sure. It's like the example, if you want to investigate whether there's a certain person in a crowded room, if you don't know clearly what the person looks like, you can do all the investigation and you'll never come to a conclusive answer, well, I'm not sure if they're in the room because I don't really know what they look like. So similarly here, if we don't have a clear picture of this me that seems to exist here, then when we look, it's going to be inconclusive. That's why in that meditation at the start, I said something like, do you have a sense that there's a me here existing from its own side, not seeming to depend on anything else to exist? Do you have that experience? So that was to then look and to start to get a clear picture of this me that seems to be here. So that is identifying the object of negation. So if we don't have a clear picture of it, then we can do a lot of investigation and not come to a conclusion. As we're going to see a little bit later in the next session probably, or maybe even later, we're going to look at the steps, the actual steps of the meditation, and the very first step is exactly this, identifying the object of negation. Because if we don't do that properly or clearly, then we can do all sorts. We can investigate till the cows come home and we won't come up with an answer. If we don't have a clear picture of what the person looks like, we can look in a room full of people forever and never come to a conclusion whether or not they're in the room. And this is the most important point in the whole process. And this is often where people go astray in this meditation. Because we are looking for the instinctive sense of me, the me that we are relating to in our behaviour. So that's the me that we're looking for. That's the object of negation. But often what people do is instead of getting a clear picture of that and then looking for that, then what people do is they come up with an intellectual idea of who they think they are. You know, based on their backgrounds, you know. And they always come up with an answer of who the me is based on some reading or their own thinking that, yes, me is the subtle energy field. Me is the subtle mental continuum. Me is this, me is that, based on their beliefs. But is that the me that we are identifying with when we get angry? Some subtle energy field or the subtle mental continuum? I don't think so. So there's no point in intellectualizing this thing. It's like if we wanted to look for a person in a room, all we got to do is get a clear picture of them. We don't have to go through some intellectual process about what country they're from, what they like to eat for dinner and all of these sorts of things. This is not going to help to determine if they're in the room or not. We just need to get a clear picture and then look. That's it. So we don't turn that into an intellectual exercise if we have to look for a person. We just get the clear picture and then we look directly. Same thing. We get a clear picture of the me that seems to be here and then we look directly and scan.
Yeah, but the problem is to get that clear picture.
Exactly, and that's why one reason why we need a bit of shamatha practice. Because if we don't have shamatha practice, trying to get a clear picture would be like someone gives you a picture, but the room's completely dark, and you can't see the picture. And they say, get a clear picture of that person. And you go, well, I can't, because of the darkness. Like now, our mind is dull and distracted, and so we don't get a very clear picture because we don't have a stable mind. So that's another reason why shamatha practice, a more stable, clear mind, can help us to really get that clear picture. But that's what we do. Intellectually, of course, we understand we are not sensations. That's easy to understand. And it's probably easy to understand that we're not the body. And it's probably easy to understand we're not the mind. But the reality is, in our behavior, we identify with all sorts of things like that as me. That's the reality. So again, we're doing it experientially. Again, you're right. Many of us, intellectually, it's easy to understand that we're not the sensations, we're not the body, we're not the mind. If we could translate that into experience, we'd be liberated from suffering. That's what we're trying to do in this meditation. We're trying to bring that intellectual understanding into experience. That's what we need to do. Because experientially, we do identify here as me. We do identify as thoughts as me. You know, we say, I am angry. No? We do. And you say, you know, I, and we often point here or here, depending on what, if we have an emotion, I don't like that. We often do that. I, and we're pointing here, I don't like that. Or I'm thinking, you know. And you're right, intellectually that's absurd to point here and say I or I, isn't it? Isn't it? It's absurd, but that's what we do. That's what we do experientially. That's the problem, is with all of these things, our intellectual understanding, particularly if we're thinking rationally, our intellectual understanding is completely out of sync with our experience. Our instinctive experience is opposite to this understanding.
It follows the question, for example, when you are really have some sort of pain, sometimes I ask myself, so okay, who is suffering? And even in that case, I can, you know, do this intellectual search.
Sure.
And see where is, I can't find anybody.
Correct. Very good.
It seems that mind is suffering, but still there is suffering, and this doesn't lessen it.
Exactly. And why doesn't it lessen it? Is because it's merely an intellectual process that you're going through. By going through that intellectually, you said, I couldn't find the me. This is a correct investigation. You have a clear picture of the me. You're clearly investigating in a good way. You're coming to the right conclusion. There's no me here I can find that's suffering. But then you say, well, but I'm still suffering. The reason is that intellectual understanding is not touching our instinctive me. And it's the instinctive grasping onto me that causes the suffering. So if we leave it merely as an intellectual process, which is actually the starting point, if we leave it there, which is in the Go Nyam talk, you know, intellectual experience realization. If we leave it as intellectual, we're going to keep suffering.
I want to, what I'm asking those questions, like I try to catch that point, the actual meditation, what I should catch.
Like that I, not finding.
Yes.
So, paradox.
Like it's like paradox. I feel something, but it's not there, and it's
right.
Like,
exactly.
And you're somewhere like out, and everything is turning off, and maybe that's that feeling that you should prolong. I don't know.
It's exactly what you said when you said you were suffering, and then you look, and then at some point you realize you can't find the me. So you get to a point of not finding. Okay, that's the experience you need to hold. And you don't take it further and think, wow, this is a paradox. I don't find it, but there's someone who's experiencing this.
No, after that, you come to that, there are already no words and no conception.
And then you hold that experience.
And you should just
Stay there. You just hold that experience, allowing it to penetrate deeper in your mind. Then instead of just being some merely intellectual understanding, you're going to start, it's going to be experiential. You're going to experientially taste the fact there's no me to be found. And if we have practiced some shamatha and our mind is quite stable and clear, that taste or experience will have a very profound impact. If we can hold that, we hold it for as long as we can, minutes or even longer. We just hold it and allow it to penetrate. Then when we get out of meditation, experientially, the sense, the grasping of me will be much reduced, which means your mental afflictions will be much reduced. Your suffering will be less without thinking about it. That's what we're trying to do. That's what we're going to explain here. Okay. So, therefore, it says here, in the next paragraph, if the object of negation is not identified, it is like shooting an arrow without seeing the target and leading an army without identifying the enemy. The analogy I gave was looking for a person in a room without knowing what they look like. Page 10, second paragraph. And here's another important point. And also with respect to identifying the object of negation, if there is an over-pervasion, then you will fall to the extreme of nihilism. And if there is an under-pervasion, since the subtlemost object of negation is not refuted, you will fall to the extreme of eternalism. So to explain that, we can talk about two extremes. The first extreme, and often it's written as existence, and here in the text it's called eternalism, is believing and grasping onto things existing independently. So that's where we are now. We are grasping onto independent me, independent world. So we're stuck here. The other extreme is non-existence, and here this is called nihilism. So that extreme is the extreme of believing or thinking nothing exists at all. Now, for us now, we believe in this. Although intellectually we may understand this cannot be that exist. Experientially, this is what we are grasping on now, regardless of our intellectual beliefs. We are grasping onto this. When we do this investigation, then what we are trying to do with respect to the person is to see how the person exists. So there is a person. Now we believe that there is an independent person. So what we are doing is we are superimposing or this on top of the person. We are making the person more solid than they really are. So the idea is to strip this away and be left with the person. But the problem is, if we take too much away, we strip away the person as well, we end up here. It's like throwing out the baby with the bathwater. We want to throw out the bathwater, but not the baby. So there is a me. What we want to throw out, the object of negation, is an independent me. We don't want to throw the me out with that, because we end up here. And that's what often happens. When people do this investigation, they throw out the baby with the bathwater, and it's very common that when we start this practice, we just flip to this extreme. That we have what's here over-pervasion. We throw out the me that does exist. We negate that as well. And so therefore, often when we do this investigation, and we come to a little taste of emptiness, then we often flip to this extreme because we misinterpret that experience to mean nihilism. So we've thrown out the baby now with the bathwater. And that's why often people develop a lot of fear when they begin this meditation, is because they've thrown the baby out with the bathwater and they feel like they're going out of existence. There's no me at all. They've not only negated the independent me, they've negated me altogether. That's what's called over-pervasion. So if we do that, then probably, if we do that in our meditation, probably we're going to have a lot of fear and we're going to end up in nihilism, believing nothing exists. The other one is the under-pervasion, and that is we're not stripping away enough. That here, we can over-inflate the sense of me in a number of levels. And I won't go into detail because it involves a lot, it's beyond this retreat. But we can strip away some of the more coarse levels of grasping and still be left with grasping onto independent existence. Then we're not stripping away enough. We're not throwing all the bathwater out. We're only throwing a bit out. So that's the two things that we need to be careful of, is to not throw out too much and not throw out enough. So we need to just refute or negate the independent me. Yeah. So you don't much difference between
just being
present.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the experience of not finding.
Yeah. The difference is understanding. Being, of course, if you're resting in the awareness, is you're resting in the open spaces and there's nothing there. An absence of stuff, yeah? The other one is also an absence, but it comes with understanding. It understands what that absence implies.
I can understand that at a point, if, you know, could we have an insight, and then the penny drops.
That's right.
And then, yeah, then there's a...
That's the difference.
Yeah.
So both experiences are similar in terms of being an absence, a vacuity. One has understanding and the other one is just a vacuity experience. So that's the difference.
Yeah, and that understanding.
The second one comes through some investigative process, mm-hmm. And it comes to the point of realizing something doesn't exist. And that is the other one is simply a lack of mental events. That's all.
No, I heard that. At some point, hopefully,
Yeah. Okay. Just to finish this point, and then there's another break, it says here, thus the dangers are very great. So it's quoting Nagarjuna here, who's the great second century master, and this Mula Majjhimika Karika, this text really was the foundation or the basis for the Majjhimika philosophical system to be developed. So Nagarjuna is said to be the founder of this Majjhimika system, which this text is following, of course. If their view of emptiness is faulty, those of little wisdom will be ruined. And there's a couple of examples here. It's just like handling a snake in the wrong way or accomplishing a knowledge mantra in the wrong way. You know, we get bitten by the snake if we can't handle it properly. We get bitten here if we, you know, go to the extreme of nihilism, for example. Thus, knowing that for the weak-minded, this Dharma here means this emptiness teaching, is difficult to fathom, the mind of the sage, again, sage is a name for Buddha, completely turned away from teaching this Dharma. So what we find actually is that this idea of emptiness, the Buddha didn't actually teach it to all people, because the danger is, you know, he says the weak-minded, the ones who couldn't really appreciate it, if they heard this teaching, then they would generally interpret it as being nihilism. Like even some of the modern day great philosophers, Western philosophers, when they read Nagarjuna's work, they say he's a nihilist. So even very smart modern day philosophers interpret emptiness to mean nihilism. So it's very easy, even for very smart people, to think emptiness means nihilism. So that's why, and of course if we end up in nihilism, then, you know, it's not a very good place to be in that nihilistic state. So therefore the Buddha didn't only taught this to the people who could appreciate it. So he taught many different levels, from very basic selflessness all the way up to emptiness. And so that's why we have the different philosophical schools based on those different levels of teaching that the Buddha gave. And so we're following this deepest understanding of emptiness here according to the Majjhimika system. So that's what we're following. And then the next sentence, and then we'll take a break. Furthermore, as said in the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 verses, so here's one of these Perfection of Wisdom sutras, and there are a number of these Perfection of Wisdom sutras, and often three of the most famous one, of course, is the Heart Sutra. And then there's also often referred to as the Three Mothers, they're called, often the Three Mothers. And often it says that's the extensive, middling and brief Perfection of Wisdom Sutra in terms of verses. So this one in 8,000 verses is the brief one. The extensive is 100,000 stanzas, and the middling is about 20,000 or 25,000 stanzas. So this is the brief sutra. It's only got 8,000 verses. And so here it says, due to grasping to I and mine, all sentient beings cycle in samsara. So again, grasping at I and mine means to grasp on to I, me, the person, to be independently existent, to be inherently existent. So this is called self-grasping, grasping to an I, self-grasping, grasping to an independent me. And in the next session, we're going to begin by looking at why is it that self-grasping is the root of samsara? Why is it that this grasping onto independent me is the root of all of our suffering? We're going to look at that as meditate first, and then we're going to look at that in the next session. And we're going to do that based on one of your handouts here at the back, Suffering and Its Causes chart. So we're going to be using that to understand how grasping to an eye is the root of samsara. But first, it's time for another break, so we'll come back at 5 o'clock.